Hey everyone, welcome to the Team Flower Podcast. My name is Kelly and we are going to dig right in today. If you're new here, I just want to let you know that we talk about flower discoveries. We have an interview with a special guest. A lot of times that is a floral designer, but we have all kinds of different people from the flower world here. So no matter what you do with flowers, whether you grow, design, create, sell, give flowers, if flowers are a part of your life and you resonate with the mission of loving the world through flowers, this is the right place for you. You have found a family to dream with. So let's dig in. Welcome to the Team Flower Podcast. I'm Kelly, and I'm here with the team. Hi, team.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
We've got Janine, Megan, Jesse, Jaclyn, and Amanda here today for another round of flower discoveries. We're going to chat about some things we've been learning about flowers. And yeah, I think that would be good. Any announcements today? What are you guys working on for Team Flower? Megan, what's on your plate? What are you working on right now?
I am working on some conference things and pulling together our speaker team for the 2021 event coming up in March. Can't announce it quite yet. Well, maybe they'll be announced when this podcast goes out, but I can just say it's going to be good. We've got some quality folks coming on.
That's awesome. So Amanda, exciting. What are you and Jaclyn working on, like emails and pretty graphics and stuff for conference too?
Actually working pretty closely with Megan on conference marketing and communication right now, and I am really excited about it as well. So if you haven't seen our speakers yet, just you wait / go to our page, because it's really because it's really exciting.
So teamflower.org/conference. And then Janine works super hard every week getting the podcast up and put together, and works with members doing articles and videos and all those kinds of things. Anything else, Janine, you want to add to that? Two babies.
Yeah, this month we're like packing the podcast recordings in. So I'm really excited about some of the guests we're going to have on, and I'm going to leave that as a, you're going to have to stay tuned to see what they are, who they are. But yeah, we've got a lot of podcasts we're recording this month, and so I'm just busy getting all of those edited and whatnot.
Cool.
And a plug for that too. If you want to write an article for Team Flower, you're interested in being featured on the blog, you can send in a proposal through the red chat button on our website in the bottom right, and then we'll route that over to Janine, and she'll work with you. So we post out 2 to 3 articles a week. And if you have something you want to share, a new technique or something you've learned, reach out. Or if you want to be a podcast guest and you want to pitch yourself that way, feel free to reach out as well.
Love it. Always love meeting new flower friends. That's what Team Flower is all about. A little connection point for everybody. It's fun to make new friends, 100%. Well, flower discoveries. I'm going to pass it over to Janine to get started today.
Yeah. So I don't know, for all of the listeners out there, whether you're a member or not, if you know, but our team, we're based in the US, and a lot of our members are from the US, but we have members from all over the world. And so I wanted to give a quick shout out to the members that we have in Australia, because I was reading through Florist Review recently and came across an article about some really exciting news that the growers there have. So many countries, Australia imports like millions of flowers every year. But I think partially with the movement of sustainability and also with COVID, the country has seen an increase in florists being more mindful of local blooms and like desiring flowers from local farms. So the Australian growers have recently started utilizing their own Australian grown flowers label. And so that those blooms are easier to find and locate. And so if you're a florist in Australia, you can be on the lookout for those things so that you can support local. And then if you're a grower, you're doing a great job. We keep it up and keep slapping those labels on. I just think that's really exciting.
That is. I'm really glad that you mentioned Australia, and big hugs to all of you who tune in from there. It's really cool. To thank you, Janine, for giving them a high five today. That makes me feel really happy.
No problem.
Anyone else have a flower discovery that they are dying to share?
I do.
Okay, go for it, Amanda.
So I have something kind of related. I came across this organization recently called Southside Blooms. Came across them this week. They were in the Floral Daily newsletter. But it's incredibly inspiring to me. It's an environmentally conscious organization that is founded and run by Keelan Blackwell on the south side of Chicago. And they're growing all of these flowers in empty lots in some of the toughest neighborhoods in the south side of Chicago. And they're doing it sustainably, and they're providing jobs for at-risk youth and young adults in the area. And then they harvest them and give them or sell them as CSAs and design them. And so it's just an incredibly inspiring organization. If you haven't heard of them yet, I highly recommend you check them out. But I was reading about them this week and was just so inspired about what they're doing and kind of transforming their neighborhoods, providing jobs, and all through the gentleness and beauty of flowers.
That's so beautiful.
Perfect. Really awesome.
I keep thinking about this organization and tearing up because I just is like, this is what I want to do one day.
Yeah.
this guy's a genius. Yeah, this guy's a genius. You don't have to include that. You can cut that a little. But
no, but yeah. That's all good. That's all good. Really beautiful. Thank you for finding that and sharing that, Amanda. There are so many ways to have a life with flowers, and you might get into it through one avenue and come out in a completely different place at the end of your life after trying many, many things in between. In Amy Merrick's book On Flowers, there's a part in the book where she's like reflecting on her life and where she was headed next. And she says, I just imagined so many lives for myself, and it's fun to have that type of approach and to know that we do get to do a lot of different things over time. So I hope that that does come true for you someday, Amanda, when the time is right.
Me too.
Well, on that note, let's sew it over and talk to our special guest today. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have our special guest, Frances Palmer, here. She's been making ceramics since 1987. She's trained as an art historian, but has always loved to work with her hands. She began as a printmaker and now as a potter and gardener. However, she doesn't make things to or grow things to hold on to them, but rather to send them out into the world for others to live with and enjoy. So her pottery is available at francispalmerpottery.com, and you can follow along on Instagram at Frances Potter. She has a new book coming out, and we are so excited to talk about the book today. Welcome, Frances.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Tell us about your book. What's it called? And tell us a little bit about how it came to be.
The book is called Life in the Studio, and it is it's sort of a group of essays that deals with all aspects of my work process that I've done over this time. And I have a literary agent who's a friend of mine who for many years kept saying, you must write a book. And I was never really quite sure what I wanted to say in the book. And then Artisan Books approached me a couple years ago and asked if I would write a book from the point of view of how I organize my studio and how the ceramics and the garden and the cooking and the entertaining and kind of every aspect of how I just live, how I could articulate that for people who are yearning to have a creative life and don't quite know how to begin. And as I say in the foreword, I'm not saying that my way is the way to do it. I'm just using how I came to certain conclusions as a means of thinking about maybe how someone could start doing things in their own way I think especially in this time where people are home and it's a very kind of uncertain time politically, that people want to find a way to express themselves that gives them some peace and tranquility and sense of accomplishment. So I'm hoping that there are things in the book that just might illuminate certain aspects that they can relate to.
Absolutely. There's a little section here in the beginning that I would love to just read back with you and have you expound upon a little bit. It says, over the years, I've met many creative people or many people who yearn to be creative. They tell me how much they wish to have their own space in which to work. And at some point, they say they will leave their day-to-day lives behind and follow their inner voice. Yet you feel that it doesn't need to be an all or nothing proposition. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I think that's something that I try to stress over and over again in the different essays in the book, that it's not really about the big leap from one extreme to the other, from a full, say, working in an office or working remotely for a company to a creative life, that there are many interim steps, and that I think the most important thing to take into account is time, and that if you just start little by little, and you know, maybe you will never fully support yourself on your own art, but there's so many parts in between that can get you where to go, to really about just making yourself feel fulfilled about what you do, and that's what I keep trying to say, is that just maybe there's a desk in your house, or a table in your house, or a room in your house, or if you want to be a potter, there are so many communal pottery studios where you can go and work. It doesn't have to be this extreme change, but yet acknowledge your desire to do something creative for yourself, and I think that makes all the difference.
There's a mantra that you express in the book several times, begin as you mean to go on. And you mentioned it, the first place that I caught it was about the essay on being centered. Tell us a little bit more about what that mantra means to you.
Well, I think it's about good intentions. One of the things I don't think made it into the book that we finally edited out is I always have had in my brain this visual of Dorothy in the movie of The Wizard of Oz, where she wants to get to Emerald City and the Good Witch says to her, "Go, you have to go find the wizard." And she says, "Well, how do I get there?" And the queen says, "Well, you have to follow the yellow brick road." And then in the movie, there's like literally the first brick. And then she like walks down the yellow brick road, brick by brick. And so begin as you mean to go on is sort of like you set an intention, but it's not something one accomplishes overnight. And you begin with that thought and your best effort, and little by little, you will get there. I feel that metaphor kind of applies to so many different things. You know, planting a garden, baking a cake. You know, if I'm baking a cake, I try to get everything organized, because you don't want to be racing around trying to find the flour or the baking soda. It's begin as you mean to go on is a sense of strategy.
I think about how you talk about working from home whenever your children were little, and how you were integrating motherhood and your creative pursuits. And you mentioned just some really subtle things that you made a habit of doing in the day, one of which I applied in my life shortly thereafter, that I really felt that it helped me a lot, because like you were mentioning, there can be this sense of chaos whenever things aren't quite ready to go. And so you have this habit of preparing for the next thing before it's time to do the next thing. And that helps it to feel very settled as you go about doing it. You want to talk maybe a little bit more about that season of life where you had young children in the studio and what that was like?
Well, I have to say, okay, granted, they're all adults now. So, and nature has this wonderful technique of making things all look wonderful. And it was a lot of work having three kids. But at the same time, they were always enormously respectful of me as an artist. And I just felt that it was a really good thing to show them that a mother has many facets. She's not just the mother. She's also a person in the world, and she has friends, and she's a wife, and but I always felt that the working really, really impressed upon them this sense of other things that people can do. And it's interesting because they're adults now, and they're all incredibly creative in their own fashion. And I think it was very important that they had a perspective on me and the attention that I gave them, because I was always present. I was always there, but yet I had this thing that I was very passionate about.
Mm-hmm. You talked about how it was unrealistic to think that you would have a long period of time to really dive into a project, and how the rhythm of life and flow was, you know, a little bit of wrapping up pots here in the morning and then taking kids to school and then, you know, putting them in the box later in the day and things like that. Can you talk just a little bit more about that? What was it like to let go of that freedom to have chunks of time of deep and intense focus? How do you transition between those two places and worlds without feeling that internal frustration? What kind of point of view or, you know, frame of mind do we need to just work in to be able to get to a place where we can flow in and out of work and life?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really about being realistic. Even, you know, even if you're working in a more public situation, how shall I say this? You know, people would say to me, "Oh, if I just had more time, I would do this." And I probably even write that in the book. Well, that idea that you're going to have more time, just it never materializes. And I think I was just always very good from the beginning, understanding that my responsibility as a mother was first. And so what was left over, and rather than wasting time worrying about not having enough time, I actually just said, okay, this is what I can get in this particular moment. But back to that essay I wrote, a row is a row is a row. I actually had that philosophy even before I had children, because I did work in an art gallery, and I was living in Manhattan, and I would take the subway, or I would always have something that I could do with my hands if I had a spare moment. So it's, I think it's just my personality. It's just my method of working. And it's really interesting, because a few years ago, I was listening to an artist on NPR saying how influenced he was by his grandmother, who did very much the same thing. She, you know, she had the bread rising and the laundry going, and, you know, she was making the pasta. And it's just this kind of concept I have of having many balls in the air simultaneously. And I'll go out to the garden and I'll pull a few weeds, or I'll sit at the wheel and do a, you know, I just have this mental idea of how to do it. And I think if people could kind of adapt to not being so hard on themselves for not being productive in a certain fantasy, that it would be a lot easier for them to do things.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the essay, it says, "And yet, little by little, the pots were finished and the children grew up." I think that's just such a beautiful way to end that. And that one is in the Routine is Everything section of the book. If you guys are looking for that, once you get Francis's book, let's chat a little bit about the garden. And I would really love to talk about your tennis court garden. Wow. And how you have turned an old abandoned tennis court into one of the most beautiful displays of contrast and beauty that I've ever seen. Tell us about that.
Well, that's really kind of a funny story. So we lived on one side of Weston for about 10 years in this mid-century modern house that was really designed for one or two people. And with the three kids and the dog and the pots and everything, we moved to the other side of town, and we found this old colonial 1850s, more kind of classic Connecticut colonial. And there was an old tennis court on it that had been built in the 1930s, and the fencing had all fallen down. And the kids were young, so we decided we would put up new fencing and a new net so that we could all play tennis and be very suburban, la, la, la. But I couldn't get any of my children to be interested in playing tennis, although they do apologize for that now. But they would rollerblade and skateboard and do all sorts of things. And I never played tennis because I was always working in the studio when I had free time. And so when they grew up and went away, I had already built a garden on one side of my studio that was about 50 feet in diameter, but fenced in because we have, in Connecticut, we have so many deer. And they would just eat all the flowers. And I was getting frustrated because I didn't have enough room. So very uncharacteristically, my husband said, well, the tennis court is fenced in. And I went, oh, you're right. What a brilliant idea. So I started with 4 beds, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago. I'm up to 30 beds now. And the net is still kind of draped on the pole. But I did put in drip irrigation because there were so many beds that there was just no way I could get around to watering everything. And it's just, and then of course, over time, the new surface of the court that we put in has started to crack. And I kind of just let everybody do its thing, and things seed in the crack and come up. And sometimes they're weeds and sometimes they're flowers, but I just sort of let everyone have their day in the sun. And I have 5 beehives on the tennis court too. And so they can just go right to their cocktail bar, which is all the flower beds right nearby. And I put the bees on the tennis court because about 4 or 5 years ago, one winter we had a bear come and keep knocking over the hives. So I moved them up to the tennis court so they would be fenced in also. And I have so many hummingbirds and all sorts of birds because I plant a lot of sunflowers so that they can come and eat the seeds. And it is really kind of magical. And when I'm up there, I always wish that everybody could have a garden. I think the world would be so much calmer. But I feel really lucky that I have that opportunity.
That made me think of a section in the book where you were, I think, expressing the sentiment that you were feeling maybe a little bit like out of sorts in the studio. You were looking for kind of a maybe feeling a little bit burned out or something. And you went up into the garden and saw a hummingbird, you know, kissing all of the dahlias, and just how that was really a refreshing moment that allowed you to get back and get on with what it was that you were doing. Tell us about nature and how that's played a part in helping to restore you in these rhythms of working.
Well, it's just, I find the flowers so incredibly miraculous on so many levels, just the sheer beauty and shape and form and geometry. I just can never get over that. And the way I organize the flowers, I try to have, starting from March, as soon as things can poke out of the ground, I have different flower bulbs, daffodils and tulips and hyacinth and muscari. And then going through to I have peonies and bearded iris, roses, lilies, and then onto the dahlias and the zinnias. And I've been transitioning a bit from, I've been putting in a lot of rose bushes and also a lot of pollinator plants, more perennials than just annuals because of the bees. And in terms of it, just, there's just something very soothing about going, standing there, pulling out some weeds. You know, obviously I have to do all the planting, and it's just something that has nothing to do with me. It's kind of like, I feel there are parallels between the clay and the garden in the sense that, you know, I make a pot or I put a plant in the ground, and then it kind of takes on a life of its own. And that to me is the mystery and the journey and what I enjoy most about it, and that it's just something I can observe and take me out of the day to day.
You talk a lot about different types of business strategies in some of the essays throughout the book as well. And I was thinking about your process of reaching out to editors and interview, pricing, sales, website, all these kinds of things. Is there anything related to business that you just feel like you might like to talk about for a few minutes with our listeners?
Well, you know, I have just a very particular point of view because I do have this business myself and I don't have employees and I've always worked by myself, which is, it's just a method that works for me. Not everybody can do that or want to do that. And I, you know, because I have, it's not like I don't talk to people during the day, but I'm very much on my own. And so the decisions I made about my business are just very personal. I'm not sure how much they, you know, I'm hoping that people can take bits and pieces and apply it to their own thinking if they want to do something on their own. But I think at the end of the day, what I think the bottom line of how I conduct my business is it honest? Is it honest to me? I when I make a pot for a customer, it's a contract. They've paid me for a product and I have to follow through with that. And I take that responsibility very seriously. So and then in terms of reaching out to editors and all sorts of people on that level, it's just been a very, very long process and people have to be patient and take the time. And sometimes I've written letters to editors or things I wanted to participate in. And sometimes it takes years, like years to get a response, but you have to, like, again, back to the metaphor about the garden, you have to plant that seed and you have to be willing to wait and bide your time and know that when the timing is right, something good will happen.
Hmm. You talk in the book, I know you'd mentioned about this business strategy being very, very personal and very specific to your situation. I feel like there are a lot of listeners who can relate to that type of desire to have something that is, just them. But you contrasted that with a trip that you took to China that was all about making pottery. We should talk about pottery today. And I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about the way that they work versus the way that you work in their you know, different ways that they're caring about creating their product. And maybe tell us a little bit about the clay along the way.
Oh, yeah. That was a brilliant experience. So I started working with porcelain, which is a very challenging clay body, but absolutely exquisite and worth all the effort. And so I applied for this residency in 2013 called the Pottery Workshop, which is in Jindajen, China. And they have been making porcelain in that city for 1,000 years. And it was where all the dynasties had their production made. I mean, there are many kilns around China, but this one had a particular expertise in porcelain. And so I wanted to go to this residency for a month to kind of understand the origins and the process of porcelain and kind of get to the soul of it and how it was started. And I was really glad that I did. And I mean, Jindajen was a challenging city. It's not large by China standards, but it was about 3 million people. It was the accommodations in the residency were perfectly fine, but the city as a whole had a lot of, I don't want to sound critical, but it was really a change for me. But I was able to go to all these historical places, look at historical kilns, meet all the people. And the process there is the majority of the work is done by mold making. And also that whereas I sit down in a studio and I make a pot from beginning to end, in Jindajen, every artisan has their own craft. So in other words, they do one step over and over and over and over. So if you throw the pots, that's all you do. If you trim the pots, that's all you do. If you glaze the pots, fire the pots, paint the pots, every like the 15 or 20 steps that I do to complete a pot would be 20 different people. And they had absolutely no personal attachment to any of the pieces. And in fact, as I say in the book, it was a very conceptual process in the sense that a person would draw a design and then it would be executed by a whole staff of people and nobody signed the piece. And it was just completely fascinating to me. And there are artists that come from all over the world. I was one of the few Americans where they work with these mold makers and they come every year and do a body of work. And then the work gets shipped back to whatever exhibition they're having. And as wonderful as it was, I realized at the end of the day that I do prefer to work on a piece myself, but I was so grateful to have gone and kind of experienced this and learned about it. And it really informed so much about how I move forward after returning from there.
Very cool. Early in the book, you talk about being centered and clay having a memory. This clay having a memory thing was really, really intriguing to me. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
It's hard. It's kind of an abstract idea, but it's so true. It's like where I write that clay has a personality. And the different clay bodies that I use, I have to respond to them differently. So clay has a memory, meaning that sometimes I'll throw a pot and then I'll set it aside and it's gone into a certain, like a bud vase, for example, where I was hoping it would be round and then you put it on a bat to dry and it kind of goes a little oval and I go, no, please don't do that. So I put it back on the wheel and I trim it and I get it all, you know, just how I want it. And then as it dries, it kind of goes back to just where that oval was. And it happens so many times. It really actually makes me laugh. Or, it's not a living thing, but it is material and it has this persona, which I always take into account. I never take for granted and I'm completely respectful of. And I've also learned that if a pot kind of shifts into its own shape, I just leave it because there's nothing I'm going to do that's going to change it. So I just let it go and see it to the end and make another piece more towards what I was hoping to have. And it's that kind of training to be amenable to something unpredictable is one of the things I love so much about working with clay.
How many pieces do you have to make to guarantee that you'll have the piece that you need to send to your client?
Well, if I get an order for one pot, I always make at least four. So
that's what I was so struck by that. whenever I read it, there's always the things that go on behind the scenes, right? That no one really knows about. And that just really made me appreciate the work that you do and the process even more so. I thought that was incredible.
Yeah, your kids are little, so you have this whole vista of movies and things to look forward to. Some of the best movies I watched were when my kids were little. And one of my favorite ones was, did you ever see that movie, The Incredibles?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, when that evil little kid has his thing on his arm to make himself into a superhero. Mm-hmm. And so this didn't get into the book either, but I love this. I think about this all the time where he goes, you know, when everyone's a superhero, no one's a superhero, right? When no one is special, when everyone is special, no one is special. So that's kind of my philosophy about making lots of pots. Like if I have a big commission, you can never just make one because if it doesn't make it through, you're doomed. But if you make a lot of everything, then no one is special and then one special one will emerge. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. That's cool. I love the way that you see the world and catch on to all those things. amazing book. Amazing having you here. Lots of recipes in there, which we mentioned a little bit, but yeah, recipes, garden travel, some more information on beekeeping and how all of those different pieces mold and meld together into a beautiful, creative life, not a life that's free of pain or hardship, but a life that's beautiful and that invites hummingbirds to come and see you. Right.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for inviting me to chat. It was really fun.
It's great to have you.
Hi, I'm Andrea Johnson of Andrea Johnson Floral Design. I'm a floral designer based in Toronto, Ontario, and I do everything from custom orders to photo shoots and events. Today, I will be sharing with you what quarantine taught me, specifically how it taught me how to break my own creative rules as a floral designer. So quarantine has taught me a myriad of things. It first started with a mixed bouquet of emotions for everyone and including myself. For me, I've been everything from frustrated and sad. I've experienced gratitude, but also defeat and helplessness. And I quickly felt like with all of my lost bookings and canceled events, I also lost my ability to create along with it. So it's quarantine. And by mid-March, grand designs were no longer highly sought after. Wholesalers were closed and supply chains were broken. As a floral artist who has a deep passion to create daily, it was impossible to do things like normally. And even worse, I felt like I couldn't design anything worth its salt. Before quarantine, I had created very specific rules and guidelines for the way I had to have things done in order to be proud of my work. So I often felt like my floral designs had to include particular types of stems. Those stems had to be placed in a specific order to achieve a very precise look. It was kind of like I was trying to mimic other florists, and my arrangements had to be photographed in a photo shoot to be deemed, you could say, good enough. And then as quarantine happened, a very dramatic shift in these rules happened as well. It made me feel like I was limited and that my work would suffer because of it. So then I thought to myself, how could I change my quarantine narrative? What if isolation and being alone could help me think differently? To see my limitations as an invitation to break the rules, to find new ways of creating with what was around me, as a way to reveal my true aesthetic. What if it was time to look around what was inside my environment and not simply what I've seen scrolling on my screen? I decided I was going to create a vase arrangement entirely composed of what I had inside the four walls of my apartment, what I could forage safely from my neighborhood, and what a small investment in a few blooms from a local flower shop could get me. Most importantly, I decided I would take the time to understand my artistic decisions along the way. So I first began by selecting my favorite container to design in. This is a vase that had been present in many other arrangements and many other photos, but that was not a detail I was going to allow myself to obsess over. Next, I was selecting what went into that container. My rule book told me to design off of a color palette, but that was when the wholesaler was open and the cooler had every tint of red and every tone of pink. The blooms I had were the blooms that were available. The investment was small, and I only chose three types of flowers, but I took the time to evaluate each bloom and why it was the right choice for this particular arrangement. Rather than purchasing greenery, I decided to forage two base foliages for my foundation and several different and unique textures while strolling through my neighborhood. I looked for unique twigs, dried goods, interesting shapes, and various colors that I never really paid much attention to before. These forage elements felt very special, like a moment in time that helped provide my arrangement with a more in-depth story about Mother Nature. Last, but certainly not least, I opened my good old refrigerator. I grabbed all the fruit inside. I had no idea if I was actually going to use it, what I was going to do with it, but there was no mention of fruit in my rule book, and that was exciting to me. So with $50 of stems, some snips from neighborhood nature, and the forbidden fruit of the fridge, it was time to begin arranging. I explored my aesthetic closer, and I got personal with each decision. Each branch and bloom was placed intentionally, because I liked the shape in that spot or how the color presented itself in that place. The foraging bits stood out as a very emotional and personal touch, because I knew where and when I had cut those pieces. the fruit, I selected grapes and a clementine, helped me to work on wiring technique while completing the shape and color depth of the arrangement. This new piece came together and it truly felt like my art. So as I sat back with the arrangement completed and on a bucket in my disaster of a studio, I started to rearrange my home. I removed pictures from the wall. I pushed furniture out of the way. I grabbed drapes from my bedroom and crates from the hallway to rig up my own photo shoot. I played with natural lighting and different odd props from around the house to create different scenes. Ironically, just a few weeks prior, I had been complaining about how my apartment was too small to take a nice photo that would look anything close to professional. Yet here I was, not only designing a beautiful face arrangement, but I was designing a set and snapping photos. It felt really good, and once I got the perfect shot, it felt even better. I was being genuinely creative for the first time and had broken all of these rules that I had in just one day, an experience I'm extremely grateful for. So I invite you to do the same. If you're curious to see the steps I took to create the vase arrangement I'm talking about here today, I have included a step-by-step guide with the original blog that goes along with this podcast. In that step-by-step guide, I share tools, the stems I use, the odd items, my design principles, the process, setup, yada, 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 all that good stuff, and a few alternatives in case you don't have everything available. But to be honest, I hope you don't go and download the document and read it. I hope you walk around your neighborhood, look in your refrigerator, and support your local flower shop to discover your own creativity with just a bit of resourcefulness. Most importantly, I hope you go and break your own rules.
Thanks for listening. You can find us over at teamflower.org for more resources like this one. And while you're there, check out the Team Flower Conference. That's where we all gather to learn and grow together. It is magic. You are magic. The work that you do with flowers matters. And we are so grateful for you. Keep going. You're doing a good job.